My name is Danielle Ciaccio, and I live in Massachusetts with my husband, John, and our three children, Sophia, Lila, and Jackson.
When he was an infant, Danielle's son, Jackson, was diagnosed with moyamoya. It's a rare brain disease that affects blood flow to the brain, and it can be difficult to diagnose.
That period of time was definitely very stressful, and just not knowing what was happening, not knowing and having a diagnosis was very difficult because we just were left with so many unanswered questions.
Moyamoya most commonly affects children, but can also present itself in adults. Part of what makes it so hard to diagnose is that it's hard to detect until it's become quite serious.
Going back to when we first realized something was wrong, Jackson was 17 months old at the time. We were running errands as a family, and then we were going to be heading to my in-laws for dinner. We finished dinner, and Jackson was crawling up their steps, so John was following him. And John, a few minutes later, called for me to come upstairs. Jackson was kneeling next to him, and he said, "I think there's something wrong with Jack. He can't crawl." And I said, "What do you mean?" And I put my arms out, and I said to Jackson, "Come see Mommy." And as he tried to crawl, his entire left side and face just dragged on the ground. We immediately picked him up and drove him to the closest hospital. And I remember looking at Jackson and saying to John, "I think he's having a stroke."
The first symptom of moyamoya is often a stroke. Terrified, Danielle and her husband got Jackson help as fast as they could.
As soon as we got to the ER, they immediately took Jackson into a room, and we knew something was seriously wrong when it seemed like every doctor and nurse in the ER was tending to Jackson. Jackson then started having a seizure, and the doctors and nurses worked to stabilize him. Once he was stable, we were told we would be flown to Boston Children's Hospital, where the neurology team would be waiting for us. We arrived at Boston Children's Hospital. Dr. Rifkin and Dr. Lehman were both the attending neurologists in the ICU. And they met me in the waiting room, explaining that Jackson would have an MRI of the brain to determine what was happening. What seemed like the longest wait of our lives was basically confirming our worst nightmare, that Jackson had suffered a massive stroke to the right side of his brain that would be affecting his left side. Dr. Rifkin came in and explained to us that he thought there were two possibilities as to what caused the stroke. The first was an inflammatory processing issue, which would be treated with medications. Or the second was this rare brain disease called moyamoya, which we had heard nothing about.
Moyamoya disease is caused by blocked arteries at the base of the brain. The name moyamoya means puff of smoke in Japanese, and it describes the appearance of the snarl of tiny blood vessels that form to compensate for the blockage. Without treatment, moyamoya can cause additional strokes, bleeding in the brain, and can even be fatal. Here's Danielle to tell the rest of her story.
In order to determine if it was moyamoya disease, Jackson would have to have an angiogram. This is when we were introduced to Dr. Orbach, who is the interventional radiologist at Children's, and he would be performing that angiogram. I remember sitting in the ICU room while Jackson was getting his angiogram, and I just remember being terrified, looking at John and saying, "He cannot have this. He's 17 months old. There's no way he can go in for this type of brain surgery." A couple days later, Jackson was able to wake up from his sedation. And it wasn't until Jackson was awake that we fully understood the magnitude of his stroke. He could not move his entire left side of his body. He could not even hold his head up. So at that point, it was uncertain as to whether or not he was going to be able to crawl, walk, talk, or regain functionality of that left side. When we had to go in for this three-month MRI to see if any changes had occurred, his MRI was flagged yet again, and Dr. Orbach had to perform another angiogram. And at this point, we knew when he came back, he was explaining to us that this was in fact moyamoya disease. It had spread quickly, and Jackson would have to go in and undergo bilateral brain surgery to restore blood flow to the brain. Although petrified with this diagnosis, we were also somewhat relieved to finally have a diagnosis and know what ultimately caused Jackson's stroke. On September 11th of 2013, Jackson underwent an extremely successful surgery. He was up and walking around the hospital within 2 days. His recovery went smoothly, and he continued therapy every day to strengthen his left side. 1 year later, Jackson had to go in for his routine MRI, and it was flagged yet again, and he'd have to have a second brain surgery. The second surgery was successful. Jackson was able to get up and move around within days. And now looking at his MRIs from where he was to where he is now, the doctors are just so happy with the outcome of how well his vessels are growing and taking over for those arteries that close. They said his MRIs look just unbelievable, which is so wonderful. Seeing those transformations, seeing him be able to make those milestones is just an amazing thing to see. And we knew he was going to keep making gains. That's why early detection and diagnosis is so important.
Facing a serious and unpredictable disease like moyamoya may be one of the most frightening experiences for a parent. One bright spot for the future is research being done at Boston Children's on biomarkers. Information that biomarkers hold may unlock earlier, more accurate diagnoses, creating new pathways for treatment and recovery. I'm Zakiya Whatley, and this is Breakthrough, a podcast from Boston Children's about the ways researchers are pushing the boundaries of what's possible in children's health. Every episode, I talk to some of the world's top researchers about how their work is revolutionizing the future of pediatrics and what that means for children and their families. When Jackson was diagnosed about 9 years ago, doctors relied mostly on imaging technology, like MRIs. These technologies are still profoundly useful, and coupled with powerful information that biomarkers can hold, doctors are able to detect disease earlier and diagnose with more accuracy. Biomarkers are biological fingerprints, so to speak, that can be detected in the body and used by clinicians to identify a specific disease. To help explain biomarker basics, I sat down with Dr. Richard Lee, a pediatric urologist at Boston Children's. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is fantastic.
Before we dive into the questions, tell us what you do for the listeners.
I'm a pediatric urologist, but I focus on pediatric urologic cancer. In addition to my clinical work as a surgeon, I do a lot of research in urinary biomarkers of primarily of renal disease, mostly of something called renal obstruction or when kidneys are kind of blocked. Mm-hmm. But we also do a lot of biomarker work stuff in a couple different areas in the urinary tract, particularly the bladder. My big focus would be urinary biomarkers in general.
Could you tell us a little bit more about what a biomarker is?
In medicine, we have a lot of treatments for different things. But in order for us to sometimes find the right treatment, we need to have what are called diagnostic tests to identify, does someone actually have a disease? Mm-hmm. And certain times, it's very, very hard for us to know if someone actually has something. Or if they do have a particular diagnosis, we want to know if it's getting worse. So this is where biomarkers come into play. They can be anything, really, that helps us make a better diagnosis. In particular to us, we look at protein markers or proteins in the urine that maybe will help us determine if someone actually has a disease or determine the severity of a disease to help us make a decision about what to do. That's the big thing that I think that diagnostics or biomarkers plays a role in, is really trying to say, okay, there are 100 kids with the same problem. Which are the 10 that need something? Because we know that 90 of them are going to get better on their own. We need to find those 10 when they all look alike.
Right now, maybe diagnosis by radiology or by imaging feels like a coarse focus knob, and maybe biomarkers are a fine adjustment knob to help you kind of see what's going on.
You know, you're absolutely right. That's a great way to think about it. It's really coming down to some people want to call precision or personalized medicine in a lot of ways.
And I'd love to have you explain the difference between invasive and non-invasive biomarkers and how that can play a difference.
In medicine, we probably could have a lot more biomarkers if we did a lot more invasive things. For instance, try to get a piece of tissue from your kidney in case you had have a kidney disease. But that's not always easy to do, and it's not something many patients would just sign up for right away.
Right.
Instead, they would prefer to have something that's less invasive. And thereby, looking in the urine, that is a non-invasive way of getting a source to look for a biomarker or some kind of signature. Even giving blood can be considered invasive. Maybe it's coming from urine, or maybe it's coming from a little swab inside your cheek and get some saliva so they can make a diagnosis. So all those things would be considered non-invasive, something kind of easy to do more than anything else.
And so when we think about biomarkers from these different sources, Dr. Lee, aside from the method of collection, which would determine if it's invasive or non-invasive, are there other differences to consider? Is everything everywhere? Or the quality of biomarkers, does that change depending on the source?
So in particular to myself and my specialty, we work on the urinary tract, which involves the kidneys, the ureters, the bladder, the genitalia, and so forth. One of the reasons we look at urine is because it is often considered the proximal fluid, or the fluid that is most closely related to those organs. So in particular, the kidney, which generates urine, that's the fluid substance that is closest to the organ of interest. That's super viable to us. And so if we could get urine directly from the kidney in particular situations, because it is the most concentrated fluid that may have the most interesting perspective of what's going on in the actual organ. Another great example would be for neurosurgeons. They have access to cerebral spinal fluid. Not easily accessed, that cerebral spinal fluid bathes their entire nervous system. And so it could be a good reflection. Now, all that said, what's interesting about urine, though, is it is a good reflection of what's going on in your entire body. Because the kidneys, for instance, they filter all of the blood in your body. And so many of the proteins that we did not believe were possibly present within the urine are actually coming from the rest of your body. They're kind of a representation of what may be in your blood.
I'm curious about if the preferred biomarker source changes depending on the type of biomarker that you're looking at.
Yeah.
Or is it type specific or system specific maybe?
Well, for instance, DNA can be seen because they really need to just get cells to get DNA. So that's why they're very interested in just doing cheek swabs and so forth. But they also can get that from the blood. But if they're very specifically interested in a body part that's affected by a very particular genetic mutation, they likely would like to get that piece of tissue that's affected. I would not say that the proteome is the only thing that you can look at in the urine. We know that for sure. There are multiple other kind of omics that can be used on the urine from anything where, for instance, we look at the transcriptome, which is messenger RNA in the urine. We've looked at the microbiome, which is a representation of the bacteria, the normal bacteria that's been in your urine or may actually be in your urine. It may not be active, but it is there. And then the metabolome, which is the metabolites. So not even protein. So these are metabolites either created by your body or even potentially created by the microbiome that may exist in the urine. Now, you can say all those ohms and apply that to pretty much any fluid substance within your body, CSF, blood, plasma, serum, and any of the tissues or cells.
Thank you for explaining that. So how are you able to do this type of work? How does this all come together without big pharma dollars behind it?
So first off, I want to say thank you to all the families who allow us to do this research by providing us with the opportunity to take samples from their children when they agree to be part of the research. It's so instrumental, and without them, none of this would really exist. It's a huge honor, to be quite honest. I mean, I think that's something special about all people who take care of children is that the families really entrust you. So we probably have one of the largest pediatric urologic-based biorepositories in the country, if not in the world. We probably have over nearly 2,500 patients represented in that biorepository. Many of them are being followed longitudinally for their particular issue and have continued to provide samples to us over time, which is fantastic. And this is the type of thing that's taken many, many, many years to kind of build. And I was fortunate to have fantastic mentors when I first started to kind of help me really think that out. And we built it from, you know, hey, patient one. And I still remember patient one in 2006. And moving forward from there, you know, 2,500 patients later, we're continuing to roll.
The development of the biorepository Dr. Lee is referring to may not have been possible if it weren't for the fundamental research from Dr. Marcia Moses, and she is my next guest. Dr. Moses is the director of the Vascular Biology Program at Boston Children's, as well as the Andrus Professor at Harvard Medical School. She has been a key figure in the biomarker movement. Her team is focused on discovering non-invasive ways to collect biomarkers from patients. She explains how proteomic or protein-based biomarkers in urine may potentially be more valuable than other bodily fluids in finding hard-to-detect cancers. Here's our conversation. Hi, welcome to Breakthrough.
Thanks so much, Zakiya. It's a pleasure being with you.
I think we just want to start by having you give us a little background on your early involvement in biomarker. You know, you've been recognized for your work, and so we'd like folks to get an understanding of that.
So we became very interested in this whole biomarker space many, many years ago. I think the thing that distinguished us very, very early was that we realized that if a test is non-invasive, the compliance increases immensely. So, you know, you would increase the almost efficacy of the test if the test did not hurt. Secondly, I've always had an interest in trying to find ways to get some of these tests to places and to individuals who do not have access to state-of-the-art technologies in terms of cancer screening, cancer detection. We're blessed here in Boston, obviously, you know, state-of-the-art technologies exist and are available, but not so much in a variety of different places, both in this country and around the world. So we decided to think non-invasively, if you will.
So tell me about what I understand is essentially a urine bank that you've built from scratch. And what kind of urine tests are you developing? Like, what are you testing for?
When we started, a lot of the resources for doing this kind of work were unavailable. So, for example, while there were blood banks that were both commercially available and available in other academic laboratories, there were no urine banks to speak of. We really began at ground zero. So we've been blessed with an amazing group of clinical collaborators here in Boston, in New England, and around the country who were willing to collaborate with us. And we were able to build really one of the first and largest institutional review board biorepositories of urine samples. Mm. And it was filled with both pediatric and adult urine samples, age-matched, sex-matched control samples from a variety of diseases, but we've been particularly interested in cancers. We've been interested in pancreatic cancer and ovarian cancer because these are diseases that are just screaming for tests. You know, in ovarian cancer, the situation is such that most women are diagnosed, 75% of women who have ovarian cancer are diagnosed after the cancer has left the ovary, and it's much more difficult to treat. So we had the samples, and the types of studies that we have done to sort of almost guarantee the rigor of what we've been working on. So we've taken a couple of approaches, a biologically driven approach where we can look at the biomarkers that might be associated with the biology of cancer. And then a totally unbiased approach where we use state-of-the-art technologies like mass spectrometry and a variety of others. We identify the proteins in both of those cases, and then we validate. We follow the rules, something called the remark criteria, the punch list that's required for you to validate these particular biomarkers. And it's been very gratifying to see a number of the biomarkers that we've worked on being tested in clinical trials.
I'd love to help our listeners understand that you can't just pull just a bunch of samples and say, okay, that's it. Like, what does it take to build a library like this?
In the very old days, urine was waste material and considered as such. So if you had the age, the gender, you know, these kinds of things, it was enough. Now, even urine from putatively healthy folks has to be collected under institutional review board protocols. And that's a big deal. I mean, so you have to write a proposal, you have to justify it. So your institution and any institution from which you are obtaining samples is involved. So it sounds just easy, pee in a cup kind of thing, but you know, there are rules and regulations. I think that's a very good thing. We established best practices protocols, many of which were established in our lab originally for the collection of urine. We also did serum and plasma and cheek swabs for DNA. But when do you put the sample on ice? How long does it stay on ice? You know, what is the temperature of the freezer? Because a lot of the biomarkers may be labile to freezing and thawing. So you have to be mindful that it is a science and there are rules. And we have helped to establish those rules and we try to play by those rules.
I'm interested in how biomarkers in urine can play a role in detecting elusive cancers mm-hmm. that don't have good diagnostics until you're, you know, well kind of into the disease state.
So a number of years ago, I had a fellow in my lab, Dr. Ed Smith, and he heard me give a talk down the street at the medical school and said, you know, Dr. Moses, there is no test for brain cancer. It's usually an incidental finding. Somebody will experience a seizure or other physical manifestations of the brain cancer. And by the time that that happens, it's usually too late. So I'd like to come to your lab and be your fellow, and we could work together maybe on biomarkers for brain cancer. And so we looked at samples that he was collecting across the street in his clinics, and we identified and validated a number of non-invasive biomarkers, proteins in the urine that could predict the presence of brain cancer. What we're all trying to do now is go upstream of the cancer that has been diagnosed. Maybe look at families who are at risk for developing these types of things to see if we can get to the holy grail of early detection. Cancers like pancreatic cancer, which are diagnosed way, way, way too late. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it's not that people aren't trying to be diagnosed. It's just that the tests aren't available. So that was sort of our motivation. So, for example, we got samples from people who had pancreatic adenocarcinoma, the most common type of pancreatic cancer. And we looked at the library biomarkers that we had from other cancers and some new ones, and we identified two proteins in the urine of patients with pancreatic cancer, which if you multiplex with the age of a patient, and age is probably the best biomarker for cancer in a lot of situations, we were able to report the establishment of a non-invasive test, whereby with just a few drops of human urine, we could predict the presence of pancreatic cancer with an accuracy of 0.956, where 1.0 is a perfect test. And there are no perfect tests. So that's terrific. And now what we're doing is looking at the urines, thanks to our fantastic clinical collaborators, from people who are at risk of developing pancreatic cancer. And we're just going to monitor them longitudinally to see whether or not these markers will flip up. And then in a lot of these cases, Akia, what we're thinking, these tests would be a sentinel for the patient and the doctor. Something is up.
It feels like there's a lot of potential there. One of the things I'd love to have you touch on for people who are hearing you tell us about ovarian cancer and breast cancer, but we're talking about urine, which feels like it's so far away from those places. Mm-hmm. How are these signals or biomarkers ending up in the urine?
So essentially, the most probable way that they're doing that is by being in the blood. And, you know, the blood gets filtered and we can find things in the urine. So in some of our early brain cancer studies, what we did was we actually tracked a particular biomarker. Now, we work in the protein space, okay, the proteome. Biomarkers come in a variety of different flavors. They could be DNA, they could be RNA, they can be proteins, a variety of different biological entities.
Okay.
So we had a couple of markers that we had shown were quite effective in predicting the presence of brain cancer. We had to start with a sample, a biopsy of the brain tumor, and we stained it for the biomarkers of choice. And then we looked in the cerebrospinal fluid, which is a highly invasive procedure and there's not a lot of it. But we got some and we showed that what was in the tumor tissue was also there at the elevated level in cerebrospinal fluid. And then we looked in blood. Now, this was, you know, per patient. We showed then that those biomarkers were in the serum and in the plasma of the blood. And then we showed that they were in the urine elevated as well. So we tracked that molecule as best we could through the human body. Turns out that a number of these molecules, of course, are in the blood, but they're not diagnostic or prognostic because healthy folks have them in their blood as well. And so the difference between the level of their presence in healthy folks versus cancer patients is not a big enough difference. So it can't give you any information about disease status or stage. But once it's a urine story, the gaps are much bigger.
Got it. Awesome. So Dr. Moses, when we think about your approach to discovering biomarkers that could be useful, how do you determine this is the protein we're going to use?
In terms of the discovery stage, we've taken two different approaches, a biased approach and an unbiased approach. The biased approach is grounded in the knowledge and information that we and others have discovered with respect to how a tumor gets established, how it grows, how it metastasizes. And we've looked at the proteins around those events, and we've hypothesized. So this is a classic hypothetical experiment. We bet that because this protein does XYZ, we might be able to detect it in the urine in a meaningful way with respect to diagnosis or prognosis. That's the biologically driven approach that we take, hypothesis driven. We also take a totally unbiased approach. It's called the global proteomics approach to identifying biomarkers, and because we focus on proteins, and the proteome is defined sort of as the collection of all of the proteins in a cell or a tissue or in a person. We've sort of leveraged some of those really sensitive technologies. One of those is something called mass spectrometry. It is a classic approach to identifying proteins. And essentially what happens is, say, a biological sample or sample of, you know, from our liquid biopsy work is fractionated. It's treated in a way so that the intact proteins are broken into small fragments of peptides, and then a mass spectrometer can analyze those fragments and give you the name of each of those peptides. And then what we do is we take that data, we search many databases that are out there, and you basically piece together those small pieces, peptides, of a protein until you have enough information to identify the full intact protein. And then we just score them. You know, how elevated or not elevated are they when we do comparisons between the disease sample and a sample from healthy age-matched, sex-matched controls. And out of that, we look at the ones that are differentially expressed, we establish a cutoff, and then we go to our biorepository and validate. So, I mean, there are all these both rationally designed reasons why we do what we do, and then there's serendipity.
Yes.
Yeah, we lucked out here.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for your time today, Dr. Moses.
Oh, my pleasure, Zakiya.
Over her remarkable career, Dr. Moses has brought together many experts, conducting countless studies to make some of the most difficult diseases easier to diagnose. Her goal is to use the power of biomarkers to give doctors and patients the proper tools to detect disease earlier and to make a difference for patients by developing life-saving therapies. Now that we have an understanding of what biomarkers are, let's shift our focus back to Moya Moya, the disease that Danielle's son, Jackson, was diagnosed with. My final guest, Dr. Ed Smith, is a pediatric neurosurgeon at Boston Children's. He's one of the doctors who operated on Jackson to help restore proper blood flow to his brain. Dr. Smith and his team have partnered with urologists at Boston Children's, and together they're looking for biomarkers in urine that identify the presence of Moya Moya disease. And they may even predict how the disease will progress for particular patients.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks for having me here.
What is it that you specialize in?
My specialty in pediatric neurosurgery is something I've really been focused on for about 20 years, is the diseases that are associated with strokes or bleeding in the brain, which is called cerebrovascular disease, and also in brain tumors. I've been trying to use what I have learned in the operating room, you know, taking care of patients with these diseases and translating it into the laboratory, and biomarkers have been a big part of that.
Wonderful. I want to hear a little bit from you about Moya Moya.
It is a condition where blood vessels inside the brain get narrowed, and the consequence of that is not enough blood can get to the brain where it's needed. Even though the brain is perfect and healthy, if it is starved for oxygen, it's at risk of strokes. If it's truly Moya Moya, and we find the disease there, there's a 66 to 90% chance of having severe or fatal stroke within 5 years from diagnosis. So it's a really bad disease. Mm. On the other hand, the good news about this disease is through the research that we have done here, both in the operating room with my mentor, Mike Scott, leading the way, and in the laboratory working on biomarkers, we have come a long way in treating this disorder. We now have, I think, the highest volume of treating kids with this disease. And we've just published a paper showing that if we can get the kids successfully treated, and we treat them with an operation right now, they can live pretty much normal lives. There's a lot of risk and a lot of scary stuff about disease, but we have a 20-year follow-up patient paper where these patients have grown up, they've had kids of their own, and I think it's in large part because of the ability to sort of push the envelope and do some of the research for this disorder.
You spoke a little bit about treatment, but can we back up to diagnosis? How typically has Moya Moya been diagnosed?
The majority of times Moya Moya is diagnosed is after something bad has happened, typically a stroke. Mm. And so a child will have a bad event where maybe some part of their body stops working. They might have a seizure. They might lose speech. That leads them to get an MRI, and the MRI shows the problem. What we're trying to work towards is being smarter about finding the disease before the children have these bad events, and we're getting better at it. One way we're just being lucky is having people get scans for other reasons. You know, little child falls off the swing, hits his or her head, we get a scan and see that something's there. That's very rare, but it's happened. What we're working towards is this idea of biomarkers and using discoveries in the laboratory to get smarter about finding at-risk people. So we have a big neurovascular group here at Children's where we have, through our research, identified certain risk characteristics. And those folks might be more subject to screening, for example, genetic testing or with some of the biomarkers we've looked at. A big success rate in this, for example, has been people with sickle cell disease, who really have become much better at finding the problem early and treating them, the kids with Moya Moya and sickle cell disease, kids that have other conditions such as Down syndrome, people that have certain types of genetic conditions like neurofibromatosis. So we're starting to make big inroads through both the clinical side in the hospital, but also the neurosurgery side to not just wait for a stroke to happen for diagnosis, but hopefully starting to get a little bit ahead of the curve and find these kids, find these families before something's bad has happened, and in the hopes that we can treat it.
I'm interested in your work in finding a biomarker in urine for Moya Moya.
So can we find a way to diagnose Moya Moya early before a stroke has happened? Can we do that with a biomarker in the urine? Can we do that in some way that's not invasive and gives us a head start? My mentor, Dr. Moses, she was wonderfully supportive. And to be clear, I am not suggesting that at least right now we have any sort of test where anybody in the population can come up, pee in a cup, and we can say, yes or no, you have Moya Moya. We're not there. But for some people, we can get a sense as to whether they have Moya Moya or not. And if they have Moya Moya, we have now got information both through the urine tests we've developed and through certain X-ray markers, what are called radiographic biomarkers, to say, gee, you know what? You're at higher risk of Moya Moya. Maybe this kind of surgery is a better or worse kind of surgery for you. And the consequence of that is some of these, particularly the radiographic biomarkers, are now part of the American Heart Association guidelines. They actually are part of the standard treatment. So we've gone from not even thinking about these, you know, years ago to now being part of standard practice. And what we've shown is that some of these markers can reduce the risk of stroke, for example, by 40%+.
Wow.
So this isn't just sort of pie in the sky research. I think this is really something where a unique place like Children's and like a lot of other academic medical centers, by combining some very dedicated doctors that see rare diseases and some super smart scientists like Dr. Moses and others, we can make a really big advance that can help children. And that to me is the greatest joy of doing this kind of work, although we certainly have a long way to go.
Absolutely. But it sounds like you've made some significant inroads so far. Is there any other reason to look to urine for the biomarkers?
It became apparent that, you know, biologically, it concentrates things. It makes it cleaner and easier to see certain molecules. Other ones that are better in the blood. So I don't mean to disparage blood. Different fluids have different advantages.
Right.
But it really has been uniquely helpful for certain brain tumors and vascular diseases like Moya Moya. They concentrate tissue. They focus certain molecules that we know are interesting and good for us. And they also are easy to collect in children and ship. We're not limited just to urine. We've looked at other types types of things in the body, including spinal fluid and blood, a different type of stroke condition called cavernous malformations. Actually, there was a big study done that showed that the stool could help predict the risk of bleeding potentially based on what's called the microbiome. So when bacteria in your gut are making different chemicals, depending what kind of bacteria are in there, and it turns out those chemicals can affect how likely or less likely it is for these malformations in the brain to bleed. So there really is, I think, a ton we have yet to learn. And that unique idea of looking in unusual places, you know, neurosurgeon looking in the urine, vascular biologist looking in the stool for brain blood vessel malformations has truly led to some innovative discoveries that have brought us on paths we wouldn't have found otherwise.
You made it clear, like, you know, we're not at the point now where someone can just, you know, pee in a cup and you can say, yes, you're at risk for a stroke or you're at risk for this type of brain bleed. But is the idea that finding a reliable biomarker, is it that you're hoping to affect diagnosis, treatment, or outcomes, or a combination of all?
The short answer is yes, all of the above. You know, if we have these opportunities, we should be taking advantage of them. I think with time, where now our real world use of these are in helping to make decisions about treatment, understanding response to treatment. We've had a big national trial on a urine test for a terrible type of brain cancer and showed that the urine test is about as good as an MRI, which clearly it's a lot cheaper than an MRI. You know, the big advantage is you can do this urine test at home and maybe not come in. This doesn't mean you get rid of MRIs, but maybe you can reduce them. I will say that we have had some really amazing luck in identifying some potential therapeutic targets. If these molecules are present in the disease state, whether they're in the blood, the spinal fluid, the pee, wherever, they must be there for a purpose. If they're there, why are they there? You know, they're not just hanging around for fun. Then we've identified a few sort of very interesting therapeutic targets. We've started applying them. You know, we've managed to cure a few tumors in mice. There really is, I think, some tremendous potential for the opportunity to use these not just for diagnosis and treatment planning, but really to create some new cures. And I'm hoping in the next few years, if we have the chance to talk again, that we'll be able to share with you where we've gone with this, because it's super exciting.
Well, I'll say curing some tumors in mouse model still feels exciting to me. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Dr. Smith.
All right. It was my pleasure.
Dr. Ed Smith and his team continue to do groundbreaking research. Moyamoya is just one of the many diseases that may one day be detectable through urine biomarker testing. It goes without saying just how many lives would be impacted if various cancers and other serious diseases were discovered earlier. This developing diagnostic tool will only further improve outcomes like Jackson's, who you heard about at the beginning of this episode. Today, Jackson is thriving thanks to extraordinary care from the team at Boston Children's.
Jackson is now 10 years old and in the fourth grade and is doing extremely well. He has overcome huge obstacles. He still has residual side effects from his stroke, but to most people that do not know Jackson's story, they would never in a million years guess that he had had a stroke. Jackson's journey has also been just a great lesson for my family, teaching us that with strength, determination, a positive attitude, and the drive to never give up, that we can accomplish anything.
I'd like to send a big thank you to all of the patients, parents, doctors, and researchers I've had the honor of speaking with over the course of this season. From precision vaccines to sports medicine and cardiac care, the people I've spoken with this season represent just a small fraction of the boundary-pushing work that is unfolding in pediatric medicine. Together with one common goal, they are continuing to make what science and human nature perpetually seek, a breakthrough. I'm Zakiya Whatley. Thanks for listening.